Last week, the RLS boys brought you their 2023 Global Economic Outlook. Now, stay tuned as promised for our 2023 Global Market Outlook, right now on the Retirement Lifestyle Show.
Welcome. You are listening to the Retirement Lifestyle Show with Roshan Lungani, Eric Olson, and Adrian Nicholson. This show is an exploration of ideas to help you work toward your ideal retirement. Get ready for the financial independence of your dreams.
Welcome to the Retirement Lifestyle Show. I'm your co-host, Roshan Lungani, here with Eric Olson and Adrian Nicholson. We've got a great episode for you today. It's the second part of a series. Eric's always advocating for a series. So we went over the economic outlook. We'll talk about the market outlook. Eric, how are you doing? You just had days with the grandkids, correct?
Fantastic. You discover once again how much energy a 7-year-old and a 4 3/4, by the way, 4 3/4, don't say 4.5, how much energy they actually have.
I mean, at that age, that quarter is a pretty big percentage of their life, right?
That is really true. Yes. It's the difference between being 16 and 17 years old, which is huge.
Yes. Yes, it is. Adrian, how about you? How was your weekend? How was your week?
My weekend was good. I'm happy to be here as always. I'm excited for this episode. Everything has been pretty normal, pretty good on my end, so I can't complain too much. Just excited to get into today's episode.
Yeah, as am I. We've got a great topic. I think this will be really useful. I always favor the topics where I think are actionable and people can start doing their research, looking for opportunities. So we're going to talk about the market outlook. Adrian, why don't you start us off today?
Sure, I'd be happy to start us off with today. And I guess a good place to really start with an episode like this on market outlook is, what are your expectations for this year? Are the markets going to have a good year? Are they going to post positive returns, or are they going to post negative returns? Do you guys want to comment on that before I get into my data?
I'll give you my thoughts on it, and then Eric, I'll let you go after that. But I do think we're going to have a positive year as after such a big negative year last year. But I think we do have the roller coaster ride. So I think we're going to have to go through some negatives first before we flip to the positive side on the year. Eric?
Yeah, I'm probably also of the view that generally when you have had a tough year, just the statistical tendency is for the following year not to be another difficult year. That's the statistical tendency. But why we should treat that sort of light, that premise lightly, is that if you look at the sources or the causes of these down years in the past, it's a lot of times there was a shock and then the shock went away. Think about 2020 and COVID, then that went away. And of course, there was a response. Like, COVID didn't go away, but at least the initial shock in response to COVID did. And then the government stepped in all over the world with a lot of stimulus. If you think about 2008, obviously a huge shock there, but then the government came in, followed in with stimulus and so forth. We're not in an environment where we're seeing, at least at the Federal Reserve level, the Federal Reserve saying, at any point soon, we're coming to the rescue. If anything, they're looking at some of the economic numbers that we talked about last time, which included things like where's employment. When we see employment too strong, we're going to turn the screws even harder on the economy and try to actually put more people out of work. So when you have the Fed actually working against the market in that way, I think we have to be careful about assuming that statistically, usually a really bad year is followed by a good year. I don't know that that will necessarily be the case here, but in summary, I do think we will end higher than we've started.
So I'm on the same boat as all of you. Yeah, we're thinking positive, though. We're thinking positive for the year, but you're not expecting a huge year, correct?
not expecting a huge year. But now that we all three of us have consensus around this, I'm starting to get very, very worried. Maybe I need to reverse my view.
Oh, always concerning.
Well, I have a data point for you, Eric, that might make you feel better, but it's just one data point that I did some research on that I thought I found pretty interesting. And I was just looking at historical data going back to 1927. So it's a pretty large pool that I'm looking at. And we probably had this conversation a number of times. You know, historical data is no indicator on what's going to happen in the future. Nobody's knows what's going to happen. We just can make an educated guess and just look at history to see if that can be some type of guide to navigate us. So I just been researching this interesting data that I found on historical returns. And before I dive into it, could either one of you tell me what's going to be a big event or a big thing that's going to be happening in 2024?
Big event happening in 2024.
The Olympics.
Other than the San Diego Padres winning the World Series, I can't think of anything really.
I mean, I guess those are both good guesses and could be right, but
presidential election.
What I was focusing on was the U.S. elections in 2024.
Uh-huh. Right.
That was
that was your second guess. All right, Roshan,
for those of you listening, we have a little bit of latency on here, so we're a little bit delayed in speaking, but I guessed it. It's on the recording. Adrian, when you listen to it, you'll hear it.
You know what? It sounded like you said U.S. Olympics. So I'm like, I'm not sure what Roshan's on today, but I don't think that could be it. So anyways, I'll just go back to it. So 2024, we have the U.S. elections. So what I did was I looked at the S&P 500 return the year before a U.S. election, and the data really surprised me. So I just took the S&P 500 of the largest U.S. companies, and I looked at how the S&P 500 performed the year before an election, and the data really surprised me. Going all the way back to 1927, there were 24 elections, and 23 out of the 24, there were positive, the S&P 500 posted a positive year. And I thought that was pretty surprising. Again, this is just one data point. Again, it's historical data. This is no indication on that the S&P 500 is going to post another positive year. But I was very surprising when I ran the number. Out of the 24 data pools that I pulled from, the S&P 500 had an 18.5% return. So when I aggregated all the data, it showed me that a year before an election year, the S&P 500 typically has a positive year. So that's one thing I thought that would be pretty interesting just to discuss and present to our listeners and viewers today as we talk about what our expectations are for the market in 2023.
There's actually the president election cycle theory is actually an approach that was founded by the Stock Traders Almanac. And so this is definitely not the first time I'm hearing this stat, and I hope you're right. Yeah, I hope that is another big positive year. This it doesn't line up with what I'm expecting, but I would welcome a pleasant surprise like that.
Yeah, it was interesting. And since I've just been giving you guys a lot of questions to answer, I'll give you one more. Do you want to take a guess the year the S&P 500 posted a negative result before the U.S. elections?
2003.
Roshan, you want to take a guess?
No, it was 99. Yeah, actually, I was going to 2003, Eric. Took me longer to get there than you, but I would agree with you.
Actually, I think I'm wrong. Okay, because 2000, 2001, and 2002 were tough. 2007. And 2000 year starting in March of 2003 was a recovery. Yeah, well, even 2007 to the end of the year. It ended the last part from October 15th of 2007 which was the peak point. Then it started to erode a little bit. Yeah. So let's just think. I'm going to guess on the basis of this. I'm going to guess it probably was 1991 because was there not the first Gulf War?
You're both off. Those were actually really big positive years. 2003, the S&P 500 year to date posted, or the annual return was 29%. And for 1991, it was 30%. The year where the S&P 500 posted a negative return, you have to go all the way back to 1931, the Great Depression, where the S&P 500 was down around 43%. The only negative year before a U.S. election.
Interesting. Well, I still believe it'll be positive. I just don't know if it'll meet the average that you had on there.
Of 18.5%. Yes, that's going to be a tough average to beat.
Adrian, did you also, by any chance, note the median value as opposed to the average value?
I can run that right now, and I'll give you that information. But I just only took the average when I looked at the data.
Okay. There are a lot of things. What is the NFL Super Bowl theory of presidential elections? It's correlation does not imply causation.
Yeah.
So wasn't it for a while that they said if an NFL team won the Super Bowl, then a Republican would be elected or something of that nature? I can't remember what that was, but
there's many stats out there like that. Yes.
I think there's reason to assign some degree of validity to this, or at least let me restate that the explanations that have been offered for why this might actually be effectual, I think they have some internal coherence to them. And so the basic idea is that whether on the left or on the right, both parties recognize that when the election comes around, that they're going to, it's going to be helpful overall to their reelection chances, both those that are in the legislature who are going on the House side be up for reelection every second year, the Senate on a rotating basis, but particularly in a presidential election, the president in particular will be making efforts in that lead up year to do what can be done to try to create the sensation of things are looking good, looking optimistic, and thereby serve the incumbent party well.
It makes sense. I mean, it's a self-preservation from an employment perspective, right? If you're the president and you want to stay the president, things have to look good for the country. And if you're the president and your term is ending, you know, you've gotten two cycles in, well, you want your party to stay in control. So you would try to keep that, make sure things go positive. Adrian, while you're looking up that data point, Eric, what did you have on your list to review?
Right. So if I'm Adrian, do you actually have that number, the median?
I still need to run it, but you can go ahead, Eric.
Okay. So I think as I think about how to look forward to 2023, the chief word I would use is remaining uncertainty. I do believe that while on the one hand we can hazard an outlook on a variety of subjects, and we will, that has to be subsumed under a larger theme of uncertainty. The uncertainty is first of all, what are the material risks at both the at level of the global economy and the national economy, and also then what are the risks inherent in a policy response or the lack thereof? And I think on that basis, we're not entirely sure what the risks are. One of the reasons for that is, as we talked about in our last episode, is that we don't really know what will take place in terms of the war between Russia and Ukraine, and that has a big bearing on energy markets, and energy markets have a big bearing on a lot of the cost of growth, and as well also have a big bearing on inflation, which the policy response is designed on two levels. First, to squash inflation, it appears, at least at the central bank level. And then at the same time, at the federal level, perhaps to promote some growth. So I think that wild card means that the uncertainty that normally governs all of our forecasts is, for me at least, even greater this year. How about you?
Yeah, I definitely think the uncertainty's high. What's interesting is regarding your data point of the war in Ukraine, I don't disagree at all, but all the analysis and things I looked at, that didn't stand out as one of the most frequent things used. It does make a lot of sense with energy. To me, that says that the markets, the and the analysts, et cetera, have just accepted that it's sort of ongoing, and that it's not necessarily a surprise. Excuse me. I think the surprise would be if it wrapped up, which would be great, and then I think that would be a positive shock to the markets.
I do agree with that. I think, and that's your statement actually illustrates for me one of the points of where earlier I asked the question, to what extent are things priced in?
Yeah.
If you look at the Russian impact on the European energy market, it's not an overnight shift to try to wean themselves off of Russian fossil fuels. And as a result, the shift in Europe to other sources of energy, I think, is a ongoing and progressive one. I think it actually will probably be a great thing for Europe to not leave itself as vulnerable as it had been to that primary source of energy. But during the period of that all unfolding, it does seem to me that presents a challenge to global growth rates. And hence, you see the large forecasting organizations like, for example, the International Monetary Fund and others forecasting slower global growth than is typical on our long run trend rate. So what does that do then to markets? So we can talk about what that will mean, but I think in general what that means is that at least in my view, you may disagree, we should probably be more cautious about most equities, not all. I still think the energy equities are still going to do well. And I think dividend paying equities are going to do well. Dividend growth equities, like we talked about in two episodes ago, are also going to do well. But but I am somewhat more cautious on equities because of what I consider to be both the Fed's determination to squash inflation, and also that the source of inflation being persistent and largely outside the Federal Reserve's control, rooted chiefly in energy, secondarily in supply constraints, including those introduced by China.
A few things that you said that stand out, that I agree with, that I've seen in my research, are one, look towards income. Two, there is definitely still uncertainty out there. And three, underweight in equities. Those tend to be frequent themes that we've seen. As we go through some of these themes, this sounds like a great opportunity to say, this is not financial advice. This is just for you to research, ideas for you to look into. If you've got questions, please reach out to us directly. We'd be happy to help, but this is just to give you some opportunities to share with you our research and analysis, to share with you some of the data we've gathered so you can look into some of the research yourself. Another theme I've seen out there I'd love your thoughts on, because I've seen things on both sides of this, emerging markets. I've seen one side of things that's saying there's an opportunity there because they're coming off their lowest growth rate and China's loosening its zero COVID policy. I've seen others that for the same reasons are saying to avoid emerging markets, that the zero COVID policy loosening up is a good thing, but they might get more COVID because of it. So there could be more shutdowns, and that just because you had low growth year in emerging markets doesn't mean this is going to be a good one. Right. So gentlemen, any thoughts or what you've seen, what you're thinking on that emerging market space in general or China specifically?
I mean, yeah, some of the points you brought up are really good. And you're starting to see some growth in that area as well right now in the market, where people are just not only just focusing on certain pockets or certain areas where they're trying to look at different economies and different markets to also add on greater diversification within their portfolio. If you're somebody that was heavily concentrated in U.S. equities last year, you definitely felt the brunt of the U.S. decline. So looking at different opportunities and different markets that aren't just solely in one country is definitely something that not only gives you more opportunity, but also greater diversification as well. But you also brought up the the good point on it's very contingent on certain macroeconomic, where if China begins shutdowns again and they're not really loosening up their policy, that's going to really impact them. If the war continues to be more aggressive and get worse overseas as well, you can see that really impact them compared to how it would to U.S. equities. So those are all things to consider.
Yeah, those are good points as well, Adrian. So first of all, there is part of me that is the statistical Eric, which says, hey, emerging markets are due. But I also have had that beaten out of me because for so many years, I've been saying, hey, emerging markets are due. And of course, they have largely gone nowhere. Now, though, it seems to me that aside from the statistical component of it, I do think there are some things that are working in favor of emerging markets. One is that there are many emerging market economies, to a greater extent than is true in developed economies, are commodity dependent. They're commodity producers, energy in particular. And with energy prices, I think having a healthy tailwind, meaning I think there's reason to believe that the energy prices will stay high. By the way, I don't remember how many episodes ago, but we did talk about the fact that if indeed the Biden administration makes good on its expressed intent to replenish the strategic petroleum reserve after drawing it down so deeply, then even after some of the other global macro impacts on energy prices might soften, then the U.S. as a buyer to replenish the strategic petroleum reserve will in fact support those prices for a while. And to the extent that that feeds into emerging market producers of oil, then that's a healthy thing. I also believe that the continued pressure on supply chains generally also works in favor of the supply and demand imbalances also work in favor of other commodity producers. So all of that being said, I think that's a healthy thing for them. The third and final component, the second major component, and then there's a third. The second is that we've kind of lost sight, or at least there was a period of time where we kept talking about the growth of the middle class consumer in some developing countries. And what you're seeing is that, though we haven't talked a lot about it, that continues apace. I'm looking at India, for example, right now. India's growth and the growth of the middle income consumer, that has just continued. So I think that story is an important one. And the third story, which I think is in supportive of emerging markets, is currency moves. The dollar had been on a tear through about 3 months ago. Then in the last 3 months, the dollar against a basket of other world currencies has fallen about 10%. That's a big move, by the way, in currency circles, the 10% move in 3 months. With the dollar weakening, that implies then that other currencies, all else being equal, are strengthening. And that, I think, also then is a largely a positive for those countries, because in that sense, they have when they generally are selling into the markets, it means that more U.S. dollars are having to be paid for what it is that they're selling.
Yeah, the currency moves last year for the dollar, it was a huge swing, right? Because it was up 20% at one point, right? Mm-hmm. Before that drop. It's interesting when you said with emerging markets and statistically you want to look at it. I tried to see if I could find some data points, and one thing that stood out as interesting is it's an article from last May, but it said that 2011 till 2021 was the lost decade of emerging markets. I had not seen that described that way before, although I've known that it's underperformed. You had also mentioned earlier, I'm going to share with you some information from BlackRock's Global Market Outlook, where you had mentioned being underweight in equities, which is one that they share. I'll give you some of their other insights just to get your thought. The first is, we prefer short-term government bonds for income. Gentlemen, any thoughts on that? No, I'll start us off.
Well,
go ahead.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I've just been looking at and had clients using treasuries for cash recently over the last few, you know, 6 months, 8 months or so. Not quite eight, probably more like six or less. But I'm just seeing that inverted yield curve in real time. And it's pretty big. I wish I could remember exactly the number, but I looked at it yesterday with a client, and you could get under a year treasuries for about 4.6. And then when I went out like 4 years or 5 years, it was down below two, right? So so I mentioned this with the inverted yield curve for those listening. That's very oftentimes a data point used to be a recession predictor. I don't remember the numbers, but it's not, definitely not foolproof. I don't know if it gets it right 60% of the time. It's definitely not 100% of the time. It's actually lower than I would have expected with all the media coverage. But the inverted yield curve means you'll get a higher interest rate for short term than you will for the long term, which generally doesn't make sense. If you're loaning your money out for the long term, you want to get paid more money for it. So now, gentlemen, your thoughts on the short-term government bonds for income.
That's where the competition really comes in, where you're seeing these articles where people are just more underweight in equities right now, where these bonds are just on the short term paying a lot more than they historically have. So some people have found that just very attractive to have in their portfolio as well. But this is something that investors are really going to be looking at throughout the whole year. And as we get closer to 2024, as we see the battle against inflation, how that pans out, how fiscal policy comes out, just to see how that really will impact where rates are headed and how, if this inverted yield curve starts to recover more, where people are more comfortable holding their money out for longer periods of time. So that's just something that really people need to consider for the short term versus the long term, where right now you're just getting these really high rates that you haven't seen before. So that's just really something that people should take a look at.
I think our listeners have heard us say more than once that, and have heard from other sources as well, that bond prices and bond yields are inversely related, meaning when one goes up, the other goes down. And it's at this point, long duration, or said differently, long maturity, it's not quite the same thing, but the concept, long duration bonds are more interest change, their prices are more interest change sensitive. So if bond interest rates are, or yields are raised, then bond prices fall, but they fall faster per percent movement upward, you know, a percent upward movement, they fall farther in price than short bonds do. So for that reason, I think it's less for me to say it's a default preference for short. It's a default avoidance of long, which means it moves me back to the short side. So yes, I think there's absolutely that. I do like that. I think it's also fair to say that there are some in we're getting outside of public securities now in my next comment, but at least in private settings, you can find private credit of a fairly a credit worthy level that's paying eights and tens. So on that basis, I think you don't need to go out 20 and 30 years to get that. You can find that in instances where it's a three year term. So, but either way, shorter term, I'm in full agreement with that.
Yeah. Well, aren't you also going to be taking on, I'm assuming, more risks too, if you're taking on something that's giving you 8 to 10%. I'm assuming you're taking on a little bit more risk compared to, let's just say, the 2-year Treasury bond, right there.
Yes, or I do wanted to highlight that I wasn't talking about some sort of ultra junk bond in this particular instance from a public company. Instead, but it is the case certainly that if you are looking in private credit, there is a different kind of risk and probably overall a greater risk, certainly a greater risk than if you're going with short-term government bonds, particularly short-term treasuries. You know, to Roshan's point, in the last few days, I've been buying in 3- and 6-month treasuries into some clients' accounts paying precisely what you said, Roshan, in that 4.4-ish to 4.6-ish area. So that's, you know, for those people that are really focused on the safety, you don't really need to drift outside. If you're looking at something short and something very safe, you don't really need to drift outside the world of treasuries to get that.
Yeah, agreed. Also, just on that, the last point on the inverted yield curve, isn't this the bond market? Would you agree that this is also the bond market saying we are anticipating a future rate cut?
In terms of how the
Fed policy
bond prices have been moving?
Yeah, like we'll give you more now, rates are higher now, but we believe in the future at some point, like if we're talking some point within the next 5 years, mm-hmm. if we're comparing it to a mm-hmm. 5-year bond, there's probably going to be a rate cut. So we're not going to lock in, give you that higher yield for this longer term.
Yeah, I think there's some of that. And sometimes, first of all, I certainly believe that the view is that the Fed's expressed intention about what they're going to do with rate policy is an area that's closely watched. And that's why you see when there's any sort of hint of news that might influence insofar as the Federal Reserve has said, these are the influences that we take into consideration when we set interest rate policy. We're looking at inflation generally, and we're looking at contributions to inflation, which among them, as we've highlighted a little earlier, include employment and unemployment. So anytime some news, you know, the regular monthly employment report or unemployment claims come out, that sort of thing, or inflation reports come out, then suddenly the market reacts thinking on that basis, how will the Fed react? So you're absolutely right that the Fed's intentions are taken into account. What's been interesting is that despite the fact that the Fed continues to profess an intention to raise rates, what you have seen and is over the last several months is a surprising tendency of the bond market not to just continue in this unrelenting motion straight down. If I look, for example, at let's say the long-term treasury bonds that as represented by one exchange-traded fund, TLT, and I look at this over the last 3 months, what you've seen is that on a price basis, that is up about 4.5%, roughly over these last 3 months. If you annualize that, I'm not saying that you should, but if you annualize that, that would be a 19% climb, just to put that in perspective. So who would have thought that in the midst of the Federal Reserve continuing to say, we are going to push rates higher, that long-term treasuries would be, in this sense at least, rallying. It just seems, in that sense at least, counterintuitive. And if I were to take into account shorter dated things, or let's say intermediate bonds, this would be now intermediate corporates. They're also up over the last 3 months on a price basis, not including the interest that they're paying out. They're paying out 4. You sit there and you think, what's going on? Why is it that the market, despite the Fed's professed intention to continue to raise rates, is allowing the bond prices themselves to move higher?
I think part of it could be we've got a lull between Fed meetings just in terms of the number of weeks. But yeah, I'm not sure about that. I'm going to go on to their next idea on here, or their next thought, which is overweight investment grade credit. Higher yields and strong balance sheets suggest to us that investment grade credit may be a better place than equities to weather a recession. This is once again BlackRock's outlook. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
If you were saying I'm going to deploy some capital into public companies, and I have now a choice of doing that on the equity or the debt side, if your overall outlook is that in general equities tend to swing in either direction more than bonds do, and your thesis is as well that the likely short-term direction, at least if not the longer-term direction, the likely short-term direction for equities is still somewhat more down, then yes, I could see why you'd say, to the extent I'm going to deploy capital into public companies, I would probably favor investment-grade bonds to investment grades, to blue-chip stocks. I could see why you might say that. I guess I'm looking at, in the last few days, I've been looking at investment-grade yields on bonds, of short durations, at least, I would rather own a treasury. The treasuries have a, generally speaking, a better overall interest rate than corporates do.
Okay, Adrian, let's go on to the next point that we've got on here. See if you've got any thoughts or ideas on this. Once again, this is still the BlackRock Global Outlook. Is U.S. mortgage-backed securities for higher income because they also offer some credit protection since they are with the government ownership of their issues. Any thoughts? Have you seen or heard or have any opinions on mortgage-backed securities?
Well, just collateralized debt obligations too. It's actually backed by something as well. Is also just a great way to just hedge yourself and have some type of protection while you're also getting some income. Those are always just a good idea for people to look at if they want to, again, just diversify themselves, have some type of degree of just protection. So it's definitely a good idea.
Yeah. Next, we just discussed this. Eric just mentioned it with the TLT, that long-term government bonds remain challenged. So we stay underweight. That's, once again, the BlackRock outlook. And then finally, they're saying they look towards certain specific sectors that they think are experiencing structural transition on the equity space. Specifically, they mention healthcare, energy, and financials. With healthcare, you've got the aging population. With energy, that's tight energy supply, which is what Eric mentioned earlier with Russia, and then higher interest rates typically bode well for bank profitability. That's their reason for that. Although they're
agree with those points.
Yeah, their overall equity exposure though is underweight. So those three areas they like, but overall they're underweight. I'll give you a couple of areas that I'd like to discuss that I found. Then I've got one final thing to share. But one are undervalued stocks. I feel like we've got a situation where I'm finding some really good individual stock deals out there. However, I do still think that overall markets are going to pull back. So it's a little bit of a balancing act there. Are you seeing similar opportunities where you're seeing undervalued stocks as a potential opportunity going forward?
Well, one common thing you're hearing is this the year for the stock picker right now? Just looking for these companies that were really beat up last year and their stock price was down almost 50, 60%. But how much is that attributed to their actual business, their revenues, their balance sheets, whatever it may be? And how much is that attributed to just the market's going down, so their stock price is also going to go down with it? So they're saying, is this the year for the stock picker? Where if you're finding some of these companies where it's a really good company, they have really good growth aspects, they're bringing a lot of money in the door, they have a strong yield, stock buybacks, whatever it may be, this might be a good opportunity to buy them at a discount. So I definitely like the idea of looking for undervalued stock that have just been really sold off because of how bad last year was, but also just their expectation on future growth is also just really important, where you're just looking for these companies and trying to weed them out from the rest.
Okay. And Eric, anything that you would add? Adrian, I completely agree with you. I'm seeing the same things. I would just wonder if it's are with the fundamental change from what we've experienced since 2009 of the really low interest rates, could this not just be the year of the stock picker? Could this be the decade of the stock picker? But I would tend to agree with that. Eric, do you have anything to add on that point, the undervalued stock space?
I would say I'm finding, in response to your question, I'm definitely finding things that I consider to be attractively priced. So one of the things I mentioned, I run a number of stock models, and I just opened up the one that I refreshed last week, which this is not a sales pitch for this model. It's just describing what I do. It takes the 4,000 some stocks. It looks at them on a variety of valuation measures. It looks at them on some momentum measures, some quality measures. And the 50 finalists that that this tool or my method, I guess you would say, put together, found those with a price to earnings ratio. The finalists had a price to earnings ratio that was at 6.8.
Wow.
That's for anybody who understands, you know, price to earnings ratios. That's a really attractive price to earnings ratio. You'd think anything that's under a 10, you would normally be pretty excited about. So, and certainly if you're below a 7, you'd be very, very excited about it. And these are also stocks that are on the move and that have, you know, pretty healthy, dividend payouts to go with it. So on that basis, I would say, yeah, I'm with you there. There are definitely attractive purchases that can be made.
Okay, and one more idea I'll throw out there to get your thoughts on are just small cap, right? These, mm-hmm. you know, typically when we get out of a recession, now there's still argument whether we'll be in one, we are one, we were in one or not, but small cap tends to help lead us out. Is that an opportunity? What are your thoughts on that?
I hesitate. Generally speaking, there's a principle that during recoveries, it's the small, undervalued stocks that have the biggest upside moves initially. And so we just call that small value in general. So one of the models that we've talked about here that I also run is watching what is the sentiment within the institutional class or tier of bond or fixed income investors. So, you know, the giant pension funds, the endowment funds, the insurance companies, and so forth and so on. So what is the outlook as reflected by what they are requiring to be compensated for owning high yield bonds in comparison to what they could accept or receive if they just bought this safe thing, which would be treasuries. What you're seeing here is that the signal that they're sending is, hey, you know what? We're not that pessimistic in our outlook. If anything, we think things are coming around. And so on that basis, I would say it may be early, and that model may be early, but that model is 50% in small value right now. So I'm with you that it may be early and it may be wrong. And I've talked many times about my willingness to be wrong. But in this case, you know, just as a data point, that just following that sentiment, that model at least has turned to small value largely.
Yeah, and we're talking about a 2023 outlook, but mm-hmm. and that, you know, that's what we're discussing today. But investing is longer term, right, than just a year. Mm-hmm. And as a huge Buffett fan, I always love sharing his quotes. One of the ones that I like is he says, "The stock market is a device for transferring money from the impatient to the patient." So when you say you might be a little bit early, and we're talking about, you know, first half of the year, it could be tumultuous, and then we think things will be, you know, better the second half of the year. That's a lot of the outlook we're seeing, and what I know we've discussed earlier in this episode. If you look out multiple years and you're able to get stocks with a 6.5 PE, that was your average, right, Eric? 6.5. Mm-hmm. I think that the outlook is bright then when you extend that time horizon. Gentlemen, mm-hmm. I've got one final thing I'd like to share. And for all the listeners, a lot of what we've talked about and a lot of the outlook, you're getting a lot of talk towards income. Barron's had a great article on income. I'm just going to list the areas they mentioned just so you can start your research and analysis. And gentlemen, if there's anything you don't like or want to second, feel free. But I'll just go through mm-hmm. the list. Energy pipelines, U.S. dividend stocks, foreign dividend stocks, convertible bonds, junk bonds, municipal bonds, preferred stocks, telecoms, electric utilities, and then they've got cash alternatives and treasuries listed. So I know that was a quick list of things. Now, this was not a 2023 outlook article. This was the title of the article is 12 Best Income Investments for the New Year. I just thought that it was worth sharing one, the article. I think it's definitely a good read, and two, sharing their categories, because so much of what we've discussed is, for 2023's outlook, is looking towards income. So do either of you have any thoughts on those categories or anything that you either agree, disagree, or anything else to share at all?
It's a great list, and I really like it. It shows there are just many great ways to get income. And Roshan, you mentioned if you want to just dive in with just research and analysis, I guess the big thing when it comes to this list is that each of these different investments have different degrees of risk, different things that can impact whether or not they're still able to pay that yield or not, or if that income is going to be consistent. I think that's a pretty good starting point to see if this would be a good place for income to be generated in your portfolio.
The one thing I might subtract from the list is municipal bonds. Not that I think municipalities are necessarily in trouble, but it does seem to me that there's not necessarily as strong an argument for those as there is for treasuries, which we've talked about a little bit earlier. And maybe the one thing that I think is absent from the list, although you touched on it in the list, was you said foreign dividend paying stocks, correct? Or foreign value stocks?
Correct. Yes.
I would say international stocks generally, although I certainly would be tilting toward the value side more, over the last 3 months, compared to the U.S. markets over the last 3 months, international has had a much stronger upward move over the last 3 months than U.S. has had, which is, of course, you have some people who are sort of perma bears about international investing. And I think, well, I understand there's been a record of underperformance there, but I think it's also worth asking why is that, and then looking for the catalyst that might make that attractive again. I need to, though, put an asterisk on my own observation about that part of that superior performance over the last 3 months is currency related.
Yeah. And with the internationals, they also, if we're really looking at, and that article, once again, was income focused, but international stocks tend to pay, in general, higher dividends than U.S. stocks, right? So that's also another reason it would be on there and worth looking into. Mm-hmm. I'm going to read that list one more time just because it was pretty quick. It's energy pipelines, U.S. dividend stocks, foreign dividend stocks, convertible bonds, junk bonds, municipal bonds, which Eric says do extra homework on. Do homework on all of them, but extra there. Preferred stocks, telecoms, electric utilities, treasuries, and cash alternatives. Now, in that Barron's article, they do list different holdings, and as we always encourage you, do your homework on these. What's interesting about the different holdings is you'll just see how significantly they vary in yield and performance. I think that just goes to show even within these broad categories, you can come up with a very different outcome. So you really should do your homework there. So we've given you a lot to think about, a lot to research for 2023. Hopefully Adrian's mean number is the right one, where we'll have a good third year of the presidential election cycle, good third year performance. And we're looking forward to a great year. We'll be back next week, with another great episode. This has been the Retirement Lifestyle Show.
Schedule a conversation with Roshan, Adrian, or Eric today at retirementlifestyleshow.com. Roshan and Eric are certified financial planner practitioners. They, along with Adrian, are investment advisor representatives and serve clients across the U.S. with financial planning and investment advice through RHA Wealth. If you found this show helpful, gained knowledge, or enjoyed the time you spent with us, tell your friends and leave us a 5-star review. This will help others discover the show. To access our show notes, to download any of the tools mentioned in today's podcast, to ask us a question, or to schedule a conversation, go to retirementlifestyleshow.com. All opinions expressed by podcast hosts and guests are solely their own. While based on information they believe is reliable, neither RTA Wealth nor its affiliates warrants its completeness or accuracy, nor do their opinions reflect the opinion of RTA Wealth. This podcast is for general informational purposes only and should not be regarded as specific advice or recommendations for any individual. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. The show hosts offer investment advice through RTA Wealth Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor, and securities through RTA Wealth Management, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC, and NFA. Finally, our music is The Chance by Jason Shaw in Audionautics. It's part of the YouTube Audio Library, and it's licensed under a Creative Commons license. I am Ray Voices. Thank you for listening.